Good evening, and thank you for joining us. We are here presenting Venture Law Meetup. This is the labor and employment session. This is our third session, and thank you to everybody for joining today again. A quick introduction of who I am. My name is Leah Brownlee. I'm a corporate attorney at Squire Patton Boggs in their Cleveland office. Historically, I've worked with startups for most of my career, whether in a startup while I was in college or law school, or working for startups in my professional career as a lawyer. And that's kind of my background and where I'm coming from on some of the comments that I say. In addition, I worked for a startup that's a spinoff of Cleveland Clinic for 6 years, and that startup was located in Buffalo, New York. So I know a few of the New York caveats on the employment side, if we need any of those. I'll let my co-presenters introduce themselves as well.
Good evening. I'm Will Kishman. I'm a counsel in Squire Patton Boggs Labor and Employment Group. I've spent my career representing private sector employers in really almost every aspect of labor and employment law, whether it be wage and hour law, setting up new entities, helping address policy matters, disciplinary decisions, union negotiations. I spent the last year and a half at Squire Patton Boggs, and before that I was at another firm in the Midwest for about 10 years. Looking forward to presenting this evening.
Hello, my name is Dylan Jeppes. I'm an associate in the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Squire Patton Boggs here in Cleveland. I've been here for just over a year. I joined directly from law school. I handle the gamut of labor and employment matters for mainly employers who operate in multiple states, including day-to-day compliance issues, many having to do with wage and hour issues, which I'll talk about today, as well as defending against discrimination and retaliation charges before governmental entities as well as in state and federal courts. Before going to law school, I worked for a startup company, and I worked for a startup law firm during law school, and that work informs my labor practice today.
Thanks, Will and Dylan. So before we start and dive into the content for the employment law, I want to do a quick thank you to all of our co-sponsors that help make this event possible. We have 10 different entities locally that have allowed, have pushed out kind of these events to all of their contacts and their network. And as the series goes on, you'll be hearing them and seeing them show up on as presenters at different subject matter. So I'll turn to Will to start.
As we're discussing the specific topics here today, we want to clarify that there are multiple ways a new organization should view employment and labor law. Labor and employment law is a series of obligations. There are many requirements an organization needs to follow in order to avoid potentially having to pay liability, be a defendant in a legal action, be the subject of a government investigation. But there are also ways that labor and employment law can actually help a new entity or a new business. There are ways that a new entity can use labor and employment law to improve recruitment, improve retention, to help protect its proprietary information, and to better position itself with regard to competitors. So we're going to be covering both the sword aspect and the shield aspect of labor and employment law this evening. We also want to mention that as people in the audience are considering the topics we're talking about, please keep in mind that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to labor and employment law. Your specific priorities are going to guide and drive your compliance efforts and your other strategies for using labor and employment law. So as you're considering the topics we discussed here today, think about how does your organization itself view matters such as recruitment, retention? Do you have the key people that you need right now? Are you planning to expand in the near future? Is your priority more focused on keeping the people that you have as opposed to growing? How does your organization view risk tolerance versus compliance expenditures? Do you have little room in your budget? Do you have almost no room in your budget to address compliance matters? How much do you need to prioritize? What role does intellectual property play in your business? Are you in a type of industry where you should be considering things like restrictive covenants, non-competes? And what does your workforce look like? What types of policies would be practical to use with your people? Where do your people work? Different states have different types of legal obligations. These are all different factors to keep in mind as we talk about the different options that are available. Now, we're going to start with one area that is relevant to pretty much all the specific topics we're going to be talking about subsequently in the presentation. This also is a very important subject for new organizations. This is something that's been very prominent in employment litigation for the last 2 years, and it's maybe even becoming more prominent despite the fact that government entities and plaintiffs are really mindful of it now. And that issue is employee versus contractor or consultant misclassification. So what do we mean by that term? That term describes a situation where an entity has viewed a particular worker as a contractor, or maybe some entities use the term consultant, under the law rather than an employee. But under the law, that person actually would constitute an employee. So why does that matter? It matters because the labor and employment laws we're going to be talking about here today almost categorically apply only to employees, not contractors, but they apply to individuals who are considered employees under the laws that are at issue. So if an entity misclassifies a person as a contractor or a consultant when they actually would be an employee under a law, then that entity might not be complying with the applicable law itself. And this can create a host of different potential problems. This misclassification might cause the entity to not pay the individual correctly, as Dylan is going to be talking about here in a moment. It might cause the entity to not secure the necessary insurance coverage, workers' compensation, not register the individual as an employee with the necessary government entities. It might cause the entity to not provide all the protections that are required under the law. For example, protections that can help further protect an individual from discrimination, retaliation, other types of employment compliance issues. And it might cause the entity to fail to retain the necessary employment records, just as some examples. Now, each different employment law applies a different test for determining whether a person would be an employee who is covered by that law or a contractor slash consultant who is not. The best way to look at these tests is to consider the questions that they all have in common, because they do all largely focus on the same questions. The most important question to look at, and these are the questions that an organization should be asking itself when it's considering, how far are we putting ourselves out there by classifying this person as a contractor rather than an employee? The most important question is, how much does your organization control the worker at issue? If your organization is imposing strict requirements about how the person performs the work, about what hours the person works, where they work, what uniform they're wearing, if you are strictly controlling the way in which they do the work rather than simply giving them a task and being satisfied if they get the ultimate task completed, then those factors are all going to significantly weigh in favor of employee status rather than contractor status. What you'd like to see for a contractor is someone who receives a specific assignment. They're permitted to perform that assignment within their own schedule. They can have a deadline, but they shouldn't be required to work from 8 to 5 every day. They should be permitted to work where they determine they can get the job done the best. Ideally, they'd be permitted to wear whatever they want. There might be some requirements about professional dress and other similar matters. And they should be entitled to use their own tools, equipment, processes, again, so long as they're actually getting the ultimate job done. Another important question is, how central are the individual services to the central function of your organization? So in other words, are you hiring this person to do some task that is just tangential to your organization's primary business line or your primary purpose? Or are you hiring them to actually help with the main thing that your business itself does? So if you're in the business of producing a new computer software program for healthcare entities and you hire someone to help you code that particular software, that person's going to be more likely to be an employee. Conversely, if you hire someone to provide logistics services, if you are in a business that involves creating a new chemical, but you hire someone to implement a new data management software, because those tasks aren't central to your business's function, they're going to weigh more in favor of contractor status. It's important to classify the person correctly within your organization and to dot your I's and cross your T's in terms of how you describe the person. This is more important because it can potentially hurt you if you don't do it right, rather than because it will cause you to prevail on this question if you do do it right. So in other words, if you want to treat someone as a contractor or a consultant, then you should be paying them via Form 1099. You should be consistently using the term contractor, consultant. If one of your supervisors maybe flubs and calls the person an employee in a series of emails, that could weigh fairly strongly in favor, actually, of employee status. It's important to be using the correct terminology, but using the correct terminology will not cause you to categorically prevail on this analysis. It might move the needle by maybe 3%, 5%, somewhere in that range.
Well, I have a couple of questions, if you don't mind. I guess first is, we know that this is a big risk, but who's going to raise the problem?
That's an important aspect of this issue, Leah. This issue can arise in several different ways, which is part of the reason why it's become so prominent lately. The government actually is specifically assessing whether employers are correctly classifying individuals. There are myriad government entities, including the Department of, on a federal level, the DOL, Department of Labor, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the Internal Revenue Service, who are all conducting specific investigations, and they're also monitoring the investigations that other agencies are conducting, and specifically assessing whether employers are correctly classifying workers. There are state and local entities who are conducting the same inquiries. And then if you have a disgruntled employee or an employee who legitimately believes that he or she has not been classified correctly, that person also can bring a lawsuit or file a claim with an agency, and an organization might be facing a claim from that perspective.
Okay. And I have some experience with the DOL audit, but I think what I understand is that the risk is around, you know, it doesn't matter how much your employees like you. You still have a potential risk of the misclassification, even if you feel like nobody in your set of employees or contractors would sue you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's always a chance that the government will conduct an investigation and independently find some issue.
Okay. Another thing, when I'm hiring an employee, an independent contractor, if it's an individual but they have an LLC, is that helpful?
That's similar to using the correct terminology to describe the worker. If the person is working through, if they're providing the services through an organization, then that might slightly increase the likelihood they constitute a contractor or consultant, but it is certainly not dispositive. And if that person is basically just calling themselves an LLC or an entity, then they still can constitute an employee. And they also can constitute an employee of your organization, even if they truly do have their own employer. So if you're hiring someone through a staffing agency, for example, even if it's totally clear that that staffing agency is their employer, your organization also could potentially constitute what's called a joint employer, that same person, and then have the same obligations as that person's clear-cut employer.
Oh, that's interesting. And last question on this topic. You know, there's a lot of clients that I work with that have software programmers that they hire overseas. So they might be coming from Ukraine, the Philippines, because there are different costs than those same programmers would be here. What did they have to worry about?
Well, if the person is working overseas and they're providing the services for a U.S. entity, they potentially still could bring a claim under U.S. employment law. It's a lot less likely, but it's definitely still possible. And then it is significantly likely if that person is working in the U.S., even if they're providing the services through an overseas organization. So, in other words, the mere fact that some of the parties are overseas does not eliminate the risk. And then on the other side of that coin, each individual country has its own laws on this issue, and although some countries impose fewer compliance obligations or might view this issue in a little bit more employer-friendly way, many countries do not, especially in the European Union, in other jurisdictions that might be a little bit more employee-friendly. This risk exists, and it might even be a greater risk.
Okay, thank you. That's all of my questions. I think Dylan, are you?
Yep. So Will alluded to some of the wage and hour issues that might arise from improperly classifying workers as independent contractors when they're actually employees. I'm about to go into a little bit more detail about those issues. So first and foremost, it's important to pay attention to wage and hour issues in order to preserve workplace morale and effectively manage your workforce. If you want to have a workforce that is invested in your company, shares your goal, and feels part of your mission, it's very important that they be paid the right amount and that they be paid on time for the work that they do. Another issue that may arise, which is, of course, very important, is that there's significant liability that is associated with underpaying people, which is a common result of misclassifying people as independent contractors as opposed to employees, or even misclassifying employees under the Fair Labor Standards Act and the state corollaries to that, as I'll get into. So recently, over a 10-year period, the average settlement of a wage and hour case was $2.2 million, and the average was $6.9 million. So the this is, of course, more typical of a larger organization that has more employees, because basically the more employees that are underpaid and the longer that those employees are underpaid just increases liability, because the back wages owed to them just increases exponentially. So it's important to properly classify employees from day one so that you don't fall into an underpayment of wages issue. And then, as Will discussed, the government agencies might come in and investigate different corporations without having any issue be raised by the employees. So it's important to properly classify employees so that they're properly paid, so that if the government does come to investigate your workplace, then it won't raise any red flags and it won't call attention to other government agencies to also come and investigate. So we'll cover the distinction between employees and independent contractors. This determination is made largely through the right to control test that Will touched on, which basically takes into consideration how much control the organization exercises over the worker. So the more control, the more the worker looks like an employee, the less control, the more the worker looks like an independent contractor. And this is important because minimum wage and overtime rules do not apply to independent contractors like they do to employees. Now, if you determine that your worker is properly classified as an independent contractor, that's great. The classification issue's done. But if you determine that a worker is an employee, there's another step. It's integral to determine whether the employee is exempt or non-exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act, or FLSA, and the state corollary. So if an employee is exempt from the FLSA and the state corollary, then minimum wage and overtime rules do not apply to that employee because minimum wage and overtime are requirements that are imposed by the FLSA and state corollaries. There are exemptions for employees who are bona fide executive, administrative, or professional employees. Those are the big three exemptions, although there are a few others. So for these three exemptions specifically, there's a salary requirement of $455 per week right now. That could go up in the future, but currently an employee, in order to be exempt under one of these three exemptions, must make at least $455 every week. That means that the employee's salary cannot go below $455 in any work week. So in order to be an exempt executive employee, generally the employee must engage in a primary duty of managing other employees and must be in charge of a recognized department within the organization. So for example, if someone is the head of the human resources department, human resources is a recognized department, and that person would meet the requirement that they supervise a department. The administrative employees generally must perform non-manual work that has to do directly with running the business, and they need to exercise significant discretion in doing so. And that's more than just following a set of prescribed steps. So they, so someone who is merely implementing a process, regardless of how complex it is, won't be properly classified as an administrative employee because having that process imposed on them takes away their discretion. And professional employees, finally, they have a specialized skill or knowledge, which is gained typically through advanced study and, generally a four-year degree or something more. And that specialized knowledge must be necessary for them to perform their job duties. So, for example, an engineer, a mechanical engineer, it needs to have at least a four-year degree to be such. And in order to perform the duties of mechanical engineer, they would need to apply the specialized knowledge and skills that they acquired through studying.
So, Dylan, I apologize. Quick question. Is there any good rule of thumb on the executive employee side of how many people need to be managed for that person to be an executive employee?
Yes, that's a good question, Leah. So the requirement is that the employee directly manage at least two full-time employees or their equivalent. So this means that the person can direct the work of two full-time employees or a combination of full and part-time employees who collectively add up to two full-time employees.
Thank you.
These duties requirements that Dylan is describing can be a little bit thick, the duties requirements being the non-pay aspects of these exemptions. A couple of practical ways that companies can get a better idea of what's required for these. Number one, the U.S. Department of Labor has some nice one-page fact sheets on their website that do a good job in roughly plain English describing what duties the people need to perform. As Dylan mentioned, these don't address state overtime exemption requirements, which can differ, especially in states like New York and California, which are a little bit more employee-friendly, but there are fact sheets available from government agencies. Some examples we often use to show the distinction between who is and who is not exempt under these different exemptions. For the executive exemption, and this doesn't cover everything, but think of the difference between a manager at maybe a pharmacy who is working the register a lot, or a manager at a fast food restaurant, they're working the register, they're not spending most of their time managing, and managing isn't really their primary function. They're spending most of the time sort of working with hourly people. So they wouldn't really be exercise, that wouldn't be their primary purpose is managing. A good example for the administrative exemption is think of the difference between a payroll clerk and a true CPA accountant. The payroll clerk isn't, it might be doing important work, it might be work that requires a lot of thought, but it's not work that gives them significant discretion, whereas a CPA is going to be exercising significant discretion about how to make certain decisions. And then for the professional exemption, think of the difference between maybe a good solid nurse practitioner and a doctor. A nurse practitioner can get to that point in her career just by gaining a great deal of experience without necessarily having nearly the same level of education as a doctor, maybe a different type of healthcare practitioner. So that nurse practitioner likely would not fall within the professional exemption because that actually requires the position to typically have very high educational requirements.
And as Will mentioned, state-by-state requirements differ regarding these exemptions, but specifically in Ohio, Ohio state law has adopted the federal standard for these three exemptions. So if you take a look at the Department of Labor fact sheets and you determine that an employee meets those requirements on the federal level, then they would similarly meet the exemption in Ohio. Non-exempt employees are entitled to minimum wage and overtime. They're entitled to compensation for every hour that they work based on these rules. In Ohio, in 2018, the minimum wage for non-tipped employees is $8.30 an hour. And in 2019, that minimum wage for non-tipped employees is $8.55 an hour. So tipped employees are subject to a slightly lower minimum wage just because they recoup the difference in tips. And in any event, the tipped employees' total wage cannot fall below the minimum wage when you take into account their wages and their tips combined. And the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. And since that's below the minimum wage in Ohio, for all intents and purposes, the Ohio minimum wage governs. Once an employee has worked more than 40 hours in a week, that employee is entitled to overtime for every single hour beyond 40 in that work week. And overtime must be at least 1.5 times that employer's regular rate. Subject, of course, to the exemptions that we discussed for administrative, executive, and professional employees. As mentioned, employees must be paid for all hours worked. And this is kind of a tricky topic because it doesn't matter if the employee is doing work during the workday or late at night, early in the morning. Whenever that employee is performing activities for the employer's benefit, they're working and they're entitled to compensation for doing so. That emphasizes the need for employers to keep accurate track of their employees' hours. Best practices for doing this are avoiding automatic practices such as if you notice that employees clock in or out early or late, automatically correcting those is a bad idea. Also, automatically deducting time from employees' days for meal or rest breaks, also not a good idea. It's also important to account for any after-hours work. So this can include making deliveries, completing paperwork, answering a call from a supervisor, or responding to an email. So we advise employers typically to restrict any employer-issued devices that allow employees to access the employer's server and to use company-issued email addresses to only exempt employees, because then it's not necessary to track exempt employees' hours and pay them overtime. And it really doesn't make a difference what if you use timesheets, what format the timesheets are in. It's really whatever works for your processes, the most important thing would just be to document the employee's hours in writing in a form that is mutually agreeable between the employer and the employee so that there won't be any dispute about it in the future.
So those are really good practical tips from Dylan about how to avoid potential pitfalls. To be clear, though, some of these requirements are not categorical steps an employer must take. They're simply ways to potentially avoid falling into a problematic area. So it is lawful to give an employee access to an email account after hours, but just if you do that, if they're non-exempt, you better be sure that you're actually recording their hours. And likewise, it's lawful to automatically deduct time for meal breaks, rest breaks, except if the state requires the rest break to be paid. But you want to make sure that if you're automatically deducting that time, that employees are not turning around and actually working during that time. So it's a balance that an organization should strike when it's assessing how well can we actually take these steps, or should we just avoid getting into these areas entirely.
And so I know a lot of organizations will text as well. So I guess text or Slack or other platforms that are not email, I guess what are your recommendations with regard to that?
They would be the same as the recommendations regarding email, because at the end of the day, like sending an email, the employee who sends a text message or uses Slack or one of the other instruments you mentioned is still transmitting a message for the employer's benefit and is therefore working.
So supervisors should really not be sending messages after hours, shouldn't be asking for work to get done in the evenings or, you know, on non-work hours.
Of course. And, of course, if an employee has an important duty and the employer is willing to pay overtime for the non-exempt employee to do that after hours, then you can send them messages or anything after hours. But if you're looking to limit the overtime or you're trying to keep more accurate track of these hours and you think you might lose track, it's generally a best practice to avoid sending work-related communications to non-exempt employees outside of work hours.
Mm-hmm. We understand we had a question submitted from the audience through our formal participant feedback service, so we're going to be jumping ahead to discussing briefly policies before we move back to talk about the use of contracts, because policies are very important way for an employer to protect its interests, but it's also important to understand the rationale behind them and when they're a good tool for a newer organization. Basically, a policy or an employee handbook or some other type of document that describes how your organization addresses certain matters can help your organization in a few different ways. Number one, it can document that you're actually complying with the laws at issue. If you have an FMLA policy, that can be good evidence that you're actually following the FMLA. They can help from more of a non-legal standpoint to establish and clarify expectations, and then subsequently from a legal standpoint, if someone violates those expectations, you can point to a document where you told the person what they needed to do and you told them what the potential consequences would be if they didn't take those steps, so it helps show that you're treating people fairly and that these actually were real requirements. They also can help from more of a non-legal standpoint by just highlighting benefits. A lot of organizations provide a broad range of benefits that employees don't even know they're receiving. Long-term disability, short-term disability, employee help programs. There are myriad different things that an organization might provide, and if you document that, that helps serve as a good reminder for recruitment retention purposes. And as another important role, they help facilitate objective and consistent treatment of workers. A very common way that might cause an employee to bring a discrimination claim or retaliation claim is if the employee sees that he or she is not being treated the same as coworkers. Even if it might not be some unlawful discrimination or retaliation that is modifying that inconsistent treatment, the employee might not see it that way, or maybe the employee does see it that way, but the employee understands the employer can't show why they treated people differently. So documenting that you're treating people consistently is a very important way for protecting yourself from legal actions from employees or actions brought by government agencies. In terms of prioritizing, in terms of the areas where a new organization really should focus, there are two overarching policies that I would describe as just absolutely critical and even heads and shoulders above some other policies that are very important. I would say it is absolutely critical to have a policy against unlawful discrimination. Discrimination includes harassment and also against unlawful retaliation. Discrimination is basically when you're treating someone differently because of an inherent protective legal characteristic, whereas retaliation is you're treating them differently because of something they did, like bring a legal action, support a labor union. And then the other side of that coin is it's critical to have a policy that shows how employees can report that unlawful conduct if they think that they've experienced it, and what your organization will do to address that unlawful conduct. That would be a complaint resolution procedure. You can use a lot of different terms to describe it. But if you take those steps, number one, it's important from a morale perspective. Number two, it can actually help you prevent any unlawful conduct that a lower ranking person in the organization might be undertaking. And number three, it actually can create a per se defense against many different types of discrimination and retaliation claims. If an employer has these two types of policies and is actually following them as they're written and if they're written correctly. So in this era where obviously Me Too type claims and other types of discrimination and retaliation claims are becoming more prominent and more having a greater role in sort of the public conscience, it's critical to have these types of policies. There are many other types of policies the handbook or set of policies might include, but some other very important ones we'll briefly touch on. It's very important to have a record retention policy so that people in your organization aren't inadvertently destroying or failing to keep track of important documents that you might need later from a legal perspective. An attendance policy is very important if you have a large number of lower ranking people or non-supervisory people, because if you don't have a written attendance policy, it can be very, very difficult to manage a situation where someone might start abusing leave or other types of absences. It's very important to have a policy that shows the steps your organization will take to address and document the fact that you consider accommodations for disabilities and religious preferences when they're required by law. That's a whole other subject. We don't have time to get into it in as much detail as we'd like, but the important takeaway is that your organization does need to consider requests for disability accommodations or religious accommodations, but you have significant flexibility in terms of what you actually provide, so that policy can help in that respect. A policy against unauthorized overtime for the reasons Dylan mentioned. If your organization is covered by the FMLA, i.e. if you have 50 or more employees within a 75-mile radius, an FMLA policy is critical. A policy for evaluating performance, for specifically listing the criteria that you consider. And then we use a lot of different terms to describe social media policies, electronic equipment usage policies, but it's very important to have a policy that describes what your people can and cannot say to third parties, what privacy rights they have in company information and company equipment, whether it be computers, fax machines, email accounts, cloud software, the privacy rights they should receive, except in some more employee-friendly states, you should be clarifying that they should not have any privacy interest in information they create or send on those types of equipment. And it's also important to have that same policy to clarify when the employee may identify himself or herself as representative of the organization, especially if you're a new organization, you're really relying on all your people to get the message out about your products and services. You want to make sure that they don't then take that same license to say something that might undermine your organization's interests and make it seem like it was coming from your organization itself.
So just a quick question, Will. Do you have any suggestions on kind of best practices for documenting that your employees understand the policies that you've adopted?
So that's a really important point, is documenting that they've received a policy, that they've had an opportunity to read and understand it, and that they've had an opportunity to actually figure out what the policy requires. The word understand itself is a little bit, I want to be clear, it's a good practice to make sure your people understand their policies. You don't want to have intentionally confusing policies, but you as the employer don't have a per se obligation to make sure that people actually comprehend everything that's in the handbook. And for practical purposes, if you have policies that describe your requirements, if they're written in plain English or as close as a lawyer can get to plain English, and if they actually, and if you provide them to employees and let employees take them home, document that employees have received those opportunities, then it's going to be very difficult for an employee to undermine the effect of the policy by claiming he or she didn't understand it.
And just another quick question. If you have non-English speaking employees, do you have an obligation to have it in a language they can read?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a unique consideration, but if you know that someone, if you know that they're not able to understand it because they speak a different language or maybe they have some sort of a disability or medical issue, if you know that someone is just legally blind, then at that point you have an obligation to provide some form of an accommodation. It might be a different law that require it for someone with a disability, but you should take a step to make sure that they have the ability to understand it, not necessarily that they actually do understand it.
Okay.
I think we'll jump back. We wanted to touch on contracts. This is a similar topic to policies, but there are some important differences. So when we use the term contracts, we're describing documents that both parties sign, that both parties understand to impose binding legal obligations. So a policy is not a contract because in the U.S., the default relationship between an employer and employee is an at-will relationship. And what that means is that either side can terminate the relationship at any time for any lawful reason, and also the employer, subject to certain limits, can change its policies, can change its terms and conditions of employment at any time for any lawful reason, again, subject to some baselines or some floors, such as the minimum wage and overtime requirements that Dylan mentioned. So you as an employer should take the position in your policies that they are at will, that they're subject to revision at your sole discretion. If right now you are having people work from 9 to 5 and later on you want to make their schedule 8 to 5, then absent some unique requirement, you have the right to do that. But a contract is something that both parties must agree to change. So typically an employer in the U.S. will not have a contract, and there's no obligation that a U.S. employer provide a contract to an employee in almost any situation, setting aside maybe a situation where there's a labor union. That said, there are many times when an employer will want to have a contract because a contract will help it accomplish its interests. Especially if your organization is creating a new product, creating a new type of service, is relying on a particular or a small group of customer relationships, relationships with suppliers, vendors, other third parties, then it's important to consider how to use non-competes, non-solicits, other types of restrictive covenants. These are contracts that can outright prohibit an employee from competing with your organization, from soliciting customers, soliciting coworkers to leave and go to a new organization. Generally speaking, they can apply both during the term of the employment and then for a period of time after the employment relationship ends. Each state has its own requirements about how far a non-compete can go, how far a non-solicit can go. States like California, New York, other states out in the Pacific West are a little bit more employee-friendly and impose a little bit more strict restrictions on an employer, what they can do. But these are at least an option in almost any industry where the employer truly has proprietary information that is not otherwise accessible to the public. And we talked in the last session, Brian Jaketic and Leah discussed intellectual property type protections such as patents, copyrights, and trademarks, but generally speaking, those types of protections cannot prevent employees from soliciting customers, soliciting coworkers. So non-competes, non-solicits, restrictive covenants are important for protecting other areas where traditional IP protection might not extend. Arbitration agreements, that's a very broad issue, but generally speaking, arbitration agreements are contracts employers can use that can make it more difficult for employees to bring and prevail on legal actions. You as the employer can enter into a contract that can A, require the employee to bring a legal claim before an arbitrator rather than before a court and a jury, which typically would be much more employee-friendly. And you B can, in almost every case, require the employee to bring a claim individually rather than joining together with a broad group of employees. And what that does is it dramatically reduces the employee's leverage It dramatically reduces the amount that a person could potentially recover in a legal action, and it strongly disincentivizes a plaintiff's lawyer to actually bring that claim on the employee's behalf. So arbitration agreements, especially for an organization that has more than just a handful of employees, can be a very important way for significantly reducing your labor and employment compliance liability.
So if I may make a few comments, so a lot of what I do, you know, if I'm touching in the employment law context, it's mostly around the restrictive covenants area. And, you know, we usually see them with executives much more so. So those are the salaried professional workers, you know, more so than with a worker that's a lower level worker, except in the software coding area. And we see them in two areas. So we see in every state, California included, during the time they're employed for you, they cannot compete with you as a company. So they can't have a night or a weekend job doing work for your competitor. And then secondly, we have the post-employment non-competition, which is where I think states like California, you know, restrict it as a matter of public policy, at least from what I've seen, and where we leave them out of the agreements. So when I'm, when I'm negotiating employment contracts, and I'm, doing a couple right now for different executives in a deal context, we include them depending on which state. The other thing that, we like to do is say that there has to be a payment that goes along with them. So it's, especially on the post-employment side, so let's say I'm sitting in New York, because I used to sit in New York, if somebody was being terminated and we didn't want them to compete with us, we would pay them severance to go along with their non-competition agreement. And the reason I reference that is because I think a lot of people think now, just because of the news, that, and I hear people say it when I'm doing deals, that non-competes are not enforceable. I don't know what your thoughts are on that kind of comment, Will, but I think they probably are in more circumstances than people think.
Right. But you touch on a good point, that there are steps you need to take in order to make sure that these are enforceable. You should draft them appropriately. You should give people what's called, legal term is consideration. You should give them something in exchange for the agreement beyond just, I'm going to let you continue to have your job. And you need to make sure you present them in a way that the employee is able to understand them. And that they can't be unlimited. There are some restrictions on how far they can go. But if you take the appropriate steps, they're certainly enforceable. And they also can have additional benefits, just, for example, creating a disincentive for an employee to attempt to contact customers or attempt to solicit coworkers or attempt to bring a class action lawsuit. So they do provide good, tangible protection, but it's important to dot your I's and cross your T's.
And while I'm skipping ahead, the other thing I work with a lot is the assignment of inventions and, startup companies, high technology, making sure that at every chance you get somebody who's going to be an inventor or could potentially be an inventor is agreeing that the company owns what they're inventing, because under U.S. patent law, that invention is owned by the individual.
Yeah. And you think of the cost versus the benefit of having an IP assignment agreement. I mean, it can be done on 1 to 2 pages of paper. It's just a matter of making sure you're drafting it correctly. And then the downside, if you don't have one, if your business is relying on that particular invention, it's a very important step.
And that has the consideration as well. I always tell people to actually pay the consideration. So in those agreements, it says for $10 or for whatever amount, but the company should actually write a check for the $10 and keep a record of it.
Yeah, it can be a gift card, it can be an extra day of leave, it can be anything, just as long as it's something tangible that's a benefit to the person. We want to touch on a couple other subjects. This is going to be almost issue spotting just because there are so many different aspects to these. We want to make sure that people are aware of the obligations that might be out there. In the hiring context, which is particularly important for new organizations, some obligations that sometimes go under the radar. Hiring discrimination claims are very common, especially for organizations that might not do things the right way. These are claims that you often see brought as class actions, because if one person is potentially treated incorrectly, that might mean that all the applicants are. So it's very important to help document that your organization is not discriminating in the course of hiring. It's important to draft your job postings correctly. We see very often instances where employers will draft job postings and they'll just unintentionally use buzzwords or terminology that might create the impression or indirectly indicate that they're considering protected classes, such as seeking young workers, seeking a recent college graduate might not even be a good idea. It's not per se unlawful, but it can give a plaintiff's lawyer a hook for claiming that the employer was actually unlawfully focusing on younger workers. It's important to be mindful of your obligations under the Americans with Disabilities Act in the course of hiring. The key takeaway here is to remember that the question is not whether the person can perform the job duties. If someone has a disability, the question is whether they can perform the job duties with or without a reasonable accommodation. So if the mere fact that you might look at an applicant or you might know something about their background that indicates they might have a disability should not cause an organization to automatically write that person off. If someone indicates during the hiring process that they have a disability, you should not affirmatively ask them if they have a disability, but if they indicate that they do, then the question becomes, can you perform this job with or without a reasonable accommodation? If they then request an accommodation that's reasonable, then you would go through the steps under the ADA, which vary from a very general standpoint involve meeting with the person, figuring out what accommodation they would like, and then determining whether your organization could provide that accommodation or another type of accommodation without incurring an undue hardship under the law. Some other ways that employers potentially fall into pitfalls, be careful during small talk all the time. You see cases arise because after a job interview, someone might ask, maybe a young applicant, a young female applicant, are you planning to settle down and start a family? If the person responds in the affirmative that they're expecting, then that can create the basis for a maternity discrimination claim. There are myriad different ways that small talk can create issues. That doesn't mean you should avoid it, but you should just be cognizant of where your questions might be driving the discussion. If you are seeking applicants for a position that is strenuous, you can help sort of flag and show that you're correctly addressing disability issues by identifying any job duties that might be physically strenuous. I mean, if it's a position that categorically requires the person to lift 60 pounds or to read for 8 hours a day or use a computer for 8 hours a day, and you flag that initially, then it's important to set expectations for the applicant so that they're not surprised and, you know, potentially think things weren't handled correctly later on in the hiring process. And that's important to understand that there are laws that govern what an organization can and cannot ask and can and cannot consider about credit background, financial background, criminal records. This is an area that depends, it varies broadly depending on the state or even some localities, especially in New York and other employee-friendly jurisdictions. They each can have their own unique requirements. As a general practice, unless it's essential for the position at issue, it's a good idea just not to ask about especially criminal arrests or criminal indictments. Best practice is not to even ask about criminal convictions unless it's particularly important. It's best not to look into people's financial history. And if you do have a legitimate need to do that, for example, if you're hiring someone who's going to be managing money or, you know, who's going to be interacting with customers or clients who might be more vulnerable than most, then understand what requirements your jurisdiction imposes. And then conversely, in many industries, you do have obligations to conduct certain types of background checks, such as in the healthcare industry, many physicians must undergo background checks. So it's important to keep all those considerations in mind when you're looking for new people.
So just a quick question. Is there anything that employers should stay away from when they're checking out the background. What I'm specifically thinking of is like Facebook or Googling somebody.
That's a tough balance, and that's an issue, a question we get a lot. Here are the pros and the cons to Googling someone or looking up someone on Facebook. The cons are that if that person is in a protected class, especially maybe on LinkedIn where someone can see that you're checking their records and you look them up and they're showing that, hey, I'm a member of this religious group or I have this disability, and you see that, then they can show if they bring a legal action that you knew they were in that protected class, whereas otherwise they might not otherwise be able to show that. Another con is that there are ways you can get tripped up. It's not unlawful in any jurisdiction I'm aware of to look at publicly posted social media information, but there are many jurisdictions that impose laws about asking third parties for their login information, for their credentials, for access to their accounts to view social media information. So maybe you have a supervisor and you ask that supervisor, hey, just give me your Facebook account so I can check this applicant. That potentially could violate a law in that jurisdiction, so it imposes additional compliance steps you must take if you're going to be considering that information. The converse is that it's I would say, unlikely you're going to learn about a protected class that you would not otherwise have any reason to know about, especially if it's someone who's reached the point where you've actually interviewed them. And this can be a way to get valuable information, especially if you're just Googling someone and something that's concerning comes up on the front page that, you know, doesn't indicate they're in a protected legal class, but just indicates that, you know, maybe they're not exercising the best judgment. That might be information that you want to know, and it might save you some costs. So really what it comes down to is understanding the legal requirements in your jurisdiction and then just weighing the pros and cons for what works best for your business. The final slide, just before we go, we wanted to flag a few other issues that some new organizations might not be aware of. And these are steps that shouldn't require a great deal of time or cost for your organization, at least time in terms of initial steps. But they're important steps to take because not taking these steps can create just per se legal violations. In almost every situation, a new organization for a new employee must ensure that person has unemployment coverage. Most states provide that. So for most states, it's just a matter of registering with the state, setting up a reserve account, and then making sure that you are deducting the necessary amounts and relaying them to the state within the time period that's required. Almost every employee must be covered by workers' compensation insurance. In most jurisdictions, you'll obtain that through a third party rather than through the state, but some states do provide it. Almost every employee must receive or work in a workplace where posters are being displayed. Every state requires an employer to post a variety of different posters about labor and employment laws, such as those that we've listed. It's important to pay taxes. And it's important to make sure that you are keeping the necessary documents and records for the worker. We've listed just a very small sample of the piece of information that must be retained for any particular employee. That's the absolute bare minimum, but it's also important to make sure that you're keeping other things such as changes in their status, any discipline they receive, any developments in their work situation, their requirements, their performance evaluations. And as we note there, an employer can retain a third-party organization to help with many of these steps. We call them PEOs, professional employer organizations, such as ADP is a common example. But there are pros and cons to outsourcing these steps. ADP can be very professional, but they are also they don't know your business like you do, and it's just another layer of potential compliance management to oversee them and make sure they're doing things properly. So these are all considerations to keep in mind when you're bringing on new people.
So I have one quick comment and one question. On the information that you retain, depending on the state you're in, the employee may have a right to see their entire file. So being careful of how you maintain it, what notes you fill in, because you may have to pull it out and hand it to an employee. So it should be kept professionally.
That's right. It's a minority of states, yeah. But that is a possibility.
And the other question, just really quickly, if you have remote employees, how do you handle the poster item?
Not every state has documented that this is okay. What we advise employers to do in most situations is just provide that remote worker with the posters, tell them to make sure that they display it. You don't want to actually go into their house and double check that they're posting it on their home office wall. But if you take those steps, then I have yet to see a situation where an employer has been penalized for not going further.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we're really at the last minute, so just a quick closeout. Next month, we're talking about tax law as we celebrate the end of the year and corporate taxes will be upcoming. In January, we'll be talking about valuing your startup company, and we'll have a guest speaker from Skoda Minotti, which is a local CPA firm. So thank you both to Will and to Dylan. Any last comments from either of you as we close out?
We hope everyone found this information helpful.
And compliance is every employer's duty.
And if anybody has any questions, our information is on the slide. Feel free to reach out to us. Happy to have a quick conversation or a longer conversation, depending on what the issue is. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.